Hi, you're listening to Saints Unscripted.
Each episode is available to view on YouTube, so be sure to check us out.
We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Enjoy the show.
It's an ahistorical thing. It's not an academic thing to expect that every single witness of an event says the exact same thing. Historians don't expect that.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Saints Unscripted. Today, my name is Alex.
I'm David.
And today we have with us Garrett, who we're going to be talking about a lot of different stuff with him. First of all, he wrote a book called Let's Talk About the Translation of the Book of Mormon. And he also is a historian, and he has his own podcast called The Standard of Truth. So basically, he knows what he's talking about, and we're excited to be talking with him today.
So tell us about your book here, Translation of the Book of Mormon.
So the point of the book is to help people get at the early sources of translation. What did the scribes of translation say? What does the Book of Mormon say about it? And, you know, what also has the church said about it?
You also covered a lot of common and or controversial questions that people have about the translation. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what some of those questions are and kind of the approach and conclusions that you came to in this book regarding those.
I would guess that for a lot of people, one of the things that makes them feel uncomfortable is that, you know, they hear, well, the Joseph Smith, you know, did he use rocks to translate? Does he have like a pet rock that he's talking to? Is this a magic rock? What is this? And then how does he use that stone? One of the first things we try to do for people as we go through the book is what if we didn't have any witness statements of the translation? What if we didn't have anything? All we had was the text of the scriptures. What could we know about the translation? And we could know a lot. I mean, the Book of Mormon itself describes the process whereby it's going to be translated quite a bit. We first would know from Pearl of Great Price, Joseph Smith history, when the angel appears to Joseph, he tells him that God had prepared stones for him to use to translate the book. And so we should already expect that any discussion of translation somehow involves those stones, because that's what the angel said. Secondly, the Book of Mormon in multiple places talks about these translation devices, these stones. Talks about the two stones that the brother of Jared had, talks about whatever translating instrument Mosiah had. He had something to translate those Jaredite records, and that he looked in them in order to translate. And then you also have an Alma, another reference to another stone, this one with the name Gazalem or Gazalem or however you want to pronounce it. I don't speak ancient Nephite, but that this stone would also be prepared for bringing these things forward. So the Book of Mormon itself multiple times talks about the fact that stones, sacred stones, will be used as part of the translation, that the way they'll be used is a seer called of God will look at those stones. And then at least, there's two separate devices that are mentioned in the Book of Mormon. There's the two stones that are bound together, and then there's the separate single stone. So those are three pretty fair conclusions you can come to just from the text of the Book of Mormon itself. And then the last one's maybe not as definitive, but that the way these stones worked, according to Alma 37, that they would shine in the darkness. So when we go then to what do our historical accounts say about the translation process, those are some things we should expect to find, that stones are being used, that the seer is looking at them, that there's apparently more than one translation device, and maybe the way that they work is that they shine in the darkness. Well, what our witnesses tell us is that the way Joseph did it was that he would take the seer stones, either the two bound together or a separate stone, separate Gazalem stone, and he would try to make the area dark around the stone so he could see what was appearing on the stone. And the way that he did it was by using his hat. So Joseph is going to take his hat, place the stone in the bottom of it. Well, why? Well, because apparently you need to make it dark enough around the stone so you can see the words that appear on it. you've got a problem, because if the room's very light, well, you need it light enough for Oliver Cowdery to be able to write. But the lighter you make it for Oliver Cowdery to see, the harder it is to see what's on the stone. So it's a lot easier to control the light around the stone than it is the light in the room. But that's a really weird image to a 21st century, well, you know, not even Latter-day Saint, anybody.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean he's putting a stone in there? So I think for some people, because they haven't thought of Joseph translating by placing the seer stone in a hat, well, that can be shocking to them. And they can say, well, wait a minute, that's not what I've always thought.
Let's talk about the witnesses of the translation, or at least those people who were close to Joseph while he was translating. There's a lot of controversy surrounding what they said about the translation. A lot of it seems to be cohesive and makes sense taken together. But sometimes there seem to be some contradictions or some questions, or some people wonder, well, okay, this guy was close to Joseph, but he didn't actually participate directly in the translation. So how would he know, you know, how it was translated? Maybe can you talk to us about what the witnesses had to say and kind of how you have come to conclusions based off of those testimonies?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because we're talking about a miracle. The translation of the Book of Mormon is a miracle. And trying to describe exactly how a miracle took place is a pretty impossible thing, right? Mm-hmm. Because the key aspect is the intervention of the power of God. And how do you measure the intervention of the power of God? How do you quantify it? There's no real way to do it. I mean, can you explain to me how it is that sight came back to the blind man when Jesus healed him? Well, I mean, I can explain that it happened, and I can explain that it's by the power of God, but I can't be like, well, what happened is in the eye. I don't actually know. So there always has to be a little bit of hesitancy when it comes to, well, this is how we know that it happened. From a historian's perspective, we look at, you know, the prime nature of the source. Was this person actually there for the event, or a contemporary of the events? Was it created at the time? Is this person in a position to know the things that they're claiming? And is this person likely to be giving an honest account? Now, again, honest account on the basis of what they think happened. I mean, different people have different experiences, even of the same event. And when they try to relate them, there's going to be some differences. In fact, it's an ahistorical thing. It's not an academic thing to expect that every single witness of an event says the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Historians don't expect that. If they all did start saying the exact same thing, then it actually starts to make you think, well, are they reading this from somewhere else? Because why are you using that same word that this person's using and that this person's using? I mean, I'm not saying that you would completely discount it, but the reality is, people share accounts based upon their experience. So that's where we have to start with. Emma Smith is the first substantive scribe for Joseph. I mean, she is the first that will write multiple portions of primarily the 116 pages. It's unfortunate that we don't highlight Emma's role as a scribe as much as we should, in part because Martin Harris lost everything that she did. But she will give accounts of that translation, both in a letter that she'll write to friends, as well as in an interview that she will give. And her purpose is absolutely that Joseph Smith was a prophet. She's not trying to denigrate Joseph. I mean, what would be the motivation for that? Because it's very clear from her writings, she absolutely believes Joseph Smith's a prophet. So why, instead of saying how it actually happened, would she make up a story of Joseph putting a stone in a hat when that's exactly what antagonists of the church were attacking him for? She says that Joseph translated using both devices, at first using the two stones bound together, and then eventually using a separate single stone, which again, the Book of Mormon talks about two separate devices, so that makes sense. She said that the way he translated was by placing that stone in a hat. We often think of, you know, a curtain being drawn across the room and, you know, Emma's on one side with her pen and paper and Joseph's on the other side with plates. Well, that had actually come to be used by antagonists to say, I know these people seem like they're credible witnesses, but they didn't see this happen. So Emma, David Whitmer, Martin Harris, they take pains to say there was nothing between us. And Emma says that, you know, I sat by him hour after hour across the table as he dictated, and there was nothing between us, right? She saw exactly what he was doing. Now, that might lead to the question of, well, does that mean Joseph had the plates out in full view then? I mean, if Emma's sitting right where you're sitting, then... And apparently Joseph has them covered during the process. So that's why Emma still never sees the plates, even though Joseph's translating. And according to Joseph Knight, one of the family friends, Martin Harris, and David Whitmer, the way that the translation took place was that a character from the plates would appear on the stone, and under it, the translation in English would appear. And so sometimes, again, that's something that, people, well, are you telling me Joseph Smith wasn't looking at the plates? I'm like, well, apparently, according to the witness accounts, he's not. According to the scribes, according to the witnesses, he's looking at the words that are appearing on the stone, and apparently doesn't need to look at the plates because the character from the plates is itself appearing on the stone. Mm-hmm. Now, someone might say, "Well, why did he even need the plates then?" Well,
needed to be within Bluetooth range.
I mean, well, maybe I don't know what the range was, but it is true that the plates and the stones, they seem to be a package deal. I mean, when the angel chastises him for asking three times to take the 116 pages, the angel takes both the stones and the plates, right? And so they seem to be together. That is something that is shared witness from other scribes like Martin Harris. Again, Martin Harris is part of this early translation venture, says something similar, that Joseph will place the stones in the hat, and that's how he was able to translate. In fact, Martin Harris at one point, Martin Harris, he's painting himself in a very good light when he does this interview, but he says that there were people saying, well, Joseph's just got, you know, he's got things written in the bottom of his hat. And so, sure, you think he's reading miraculously, but he's just got like a sheet down there. And when Martin Harris turns, he puts another sheet in there. And like, hey, Martin, what's that over there? And thus saith, you know, it seems pretty preposterous, honestly. But because Martin Harris says that, because people were saying that one time they go down to skip rocks at the river to take a break, which seems like it's high entertainment in the 19th century, but... And he finds a stone that looks almost exactly like the seer stone. And so he pockets it, and he goes back, gets into the room first, and he switches out the stones. Now, he says he did that to try to silence critics who are saying, oh, no, Joseph's just, he's got paper in there. And Joseph, you know, according to Martin Harris, comes to translate, and he can't. He can't translate because it's not the sacred stone that God had prepared for the purpose.
All is as dark as Egypt.
That he can't see. And in fact, so you have this kind of physical aspect of it, right? That there's a stone. These stones are prepared by God. They are holy, which is the reason why Joseph will eventually start using the term Urim and Thummim to describe them. Early on, he doesn't. Early on, they use the term spectacles. They use the term stones. They use the term interpreters. But by late 1832, you have antagonists of the church mocking the translation process. And so I think that that's when they adopt this biblical term to try to, you know, because who's mocking them? Well, it's Christians, right? Oh, you're trying to tell me that God would use stones? And so I think Joseph is saying, yeah, just like the high priest of Israel was given holy stones by God in order to receive revelation, you know, like that. And so they start to use the term Urim and Thummim to mean any seer stone. And that can really confuse people, because I know growing up, I always thought, well, there's two stones. This one's probably named Urim and this one's named Thummim. Right? I mean, maybe I shouldn't be telling everyone my poor thought process, but that's what I always thought until I got further into the literature and reading the sources. And what became clear is that Joseph's using the term Urim and Thummim to mean any seer stone. Long after the two stones have gone back with the angel, in 1841, he shows Wilford Woodruff a seer stone and calls it a Urim and Thummim, right? A single stone. Well, Wilford Woodruff's all kinds of excited. He's writing in his journal, oh, I saw it today. He's really excited about it. But that can also kind of cause problems because people say, well, what is he using to translate? Is he using the separate stone? Is he using the two stones? And by the time the histories are being written in 1838, they're using the term Urim and Thummim for everything. They're using it, I mean, what is this world going to be like in its glorified, sanctified state? A giant Urim and Thummim, not the ones Joseph found in the box. It's clearly a generic term, but sometimes we make it more specific. I think the most important thing that I'd want people to take away from this and to take away from, you know, learning about the translation period, if you're sitting there thinking, well, that's not how I think it happened, that's fine. What matters is that it happened. Read the Book of Mormon, then read literally anything Joseph Smith wrote at the time. It will be crystal clear to you that this is by the gift and power of God.
Beautifully said.
Love it.
That's wonderful. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you so much, Garrett, for coming on today. If anybody has any questions for you, are they okay to leave that in the comments? Or...
Sure.
Great. Awesome.
Great. Guys, check out the book. Yeah. And check out the podcast. He's a very entertaining guy to listen to if you haven't been able to.
He has got a lot of knowledge, as we've seen today.
Yes.
So thank you so much for watching, and we'll see you guys next time.
Bye. Thanks for listening.
Be sure to check us out on YouTube.
And you can message us on Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok. Bye!